Well, takeaway listeners, you made it another week. This is Friday, August 25th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute in This Week. Todd Zwillick is back on Monday. Thanks so much for listening. We begin this hour with a conversation about secession. This isn't a revisiting of the Civil War or a renewed debate about Texas's independence. Secession is something that is happening right now in municipalities across the country, where communities are seeking to pull out of larger school districts to provide what they see as a better education for their kids. Since 2000, 71 communities nationwide have tried to secede. 47 of those cases were successful. The remainder were dropped, defeated, or tied up in courts.
Well, I really believe that the public education is the cornerstone of any community.
That's David Pickler of Germantown, Tennessee. He has firsthand experience with school district secession. He was the chairman of the Board of Education of Shelby County in Tennessee, a county that now includes Memphis. Memphis used to have its own school district that was much poorer and had more students of color than the surrounding areas, but the city district merged with the surrounding county a few years ago. A year later, six Memphis suburbs that were part of the original whiter and wealthier Shelby County district got permission from the state legislature to secede into their own six smaller districts. David Pickler is from one of those suburbs.
And so what they really did was not really secede from the larger district that had been forced upon them, but it really was to preserve the independence that they believed that they had as a right of citizens to be able to have the kind of education in their communities that they wanted.
How did the economic and ethnic racial diversity of Shelby County and these six suburbs compare to the larger Memphis school system into which they had been absorbed?
Taking as an aggregate, the six communities that were part of the old Shelby County district had a racial makeup that was basically about 49% Caucasian and about 51% a mix of African-American, Hispanic, Asian-American. It was a highly diverse school system. It was a district that also was growing in socioeconomic diversity. We had over 30% of our school system that was on free and reduced price lunch. The old Memphis City School System was a district that was about 92% African-American and nearly 100% free and reduced price lunch.
What was the new economic and racial diversity of these six new school districts?
And Indira, those six districts did account for probably 90% of the former population of the old Shelby County district. So that's why I said in aggregate, districts that would probably be well in excess of 45% non-Caucasian. So there's not a significant difference in the racial makeup and the diversity in the six independent municipal districts as opposed to the complexity and the nature of the old Shelby County district.
And each of them had roughly 30% free and reduced lunch, low-income children, you're saying?
No, I would say in terms of the economic diversity, the socioeconomic background, we had more concentration of the low-income students in a couple of those six districts. So it was not as evenly dispersed among the six districts. But in terms of the racial diversity, then the racial diversity was fairly evenly spread out among the six communities.
Now, schools elsewhere have asked your advice on how to secede from their larger districts. Starting a new school district from scratch costs money. Districts have to raise taxes. What do you tell them about the costs versus the benefits?
One of the things that we have learned about public education, and I had the honor a few years ago serving as the president of the National School Boards Association. So I traveled all over America, you know, advocating for public education. And I believe fervently that public education is the single most important responsibility of government. And so what we've learned about public education is if you have communities where you have strong public schools, this is a magnet for growth and for development. Yes, you will probably see your property tax rates go up. You probably will see the costs associated with the government increase. But what you also will see is higher property values, greater community engagement. Those local community priorities can be a building block for making their community stronger and better and more efficient.
Now, you have said that Shelby County never wanted to merge with Memphis City in the first place. How much of that honestly had to do with socioeconomic status or race of the larger Memphis City district?
It had absolutely nothing to do with the racial components or the socioeconomics. What it really came down to was this. We had a district in Shelby County that was effective, efficient, was high functioning, and was delivering great results for our community. Ultimately, political agendas beyond our control dictated that that would no longer be allowed. The issue was not about race, was not about economics. We were a highly diverse district. The issue was about academic quality, about preserving public education as the fabric of our community and making high-quality public education our aim, no matter where we were dealing with in terms of the socioeconomic background, as well as the racial background, the ethnic background. Our objective was to educate children and to provide that local component of leadership to ensure that high-quality education was what it was all about.
So it turned out well for the students in the six districts of Shelby County that seceded. Do you worry that the children of the Memphis district ended up paying the price so the kids in the six districts of Shelby County could benefit?
Oh, there's no question, Indira. The focus that was lost for the children of the city of Memphis, to me, is the greatest tragedy of all. And ultimately, I do believe that the children of the city of Memphis were the victims, not because of the decision to form the independent districts that was made by the six local communities. That was not the reason that they may have suffered. It was the wrong-headed decision-making by the former school board in Memphis and by those power brokers within the city of Memphis who were pursuing an economic and political agenda that ultimately the children of the city of Memphis were pawns in their process.
David Pickler served as the last chairman of the Shelby County Board of Education before it merged with the Memphis schools, and he's a former president of the National School Board Association. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now let's look at the bigger picture. Erica Wilson is the Reef Ivey Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she studied this phenomenon of school district secession across the country. She says while proponents of the practice want a better education for their kids, it comes at a cost to the districts and the children left behind.
So it's important to understand that the secession movement itself is not new. In the aftermath of Brown versus Board of Education, a number of municipalities attempted to secede from larger county-based school districts, particularly in the South, in order to avoid desegregation or integrating. So the Supreme Court put a halt to that with a ruling that found that secession was not permissible if the effect of the secession would be to impede desegregation efforts. But fast forward here in 2017, and a number of the school systems that were previously being monitored by federal courts to make sure that they are properly desegregating are no longer under federal court supervision. So what that's meant is that as demographics have changed and there are more students of color in our public schools, some municipalities have creatively found ways to isolate resources to separate from larger numbers of students of color. And so that's where this new secession movement is taking place. I like to call it the new school segregation. It is a new form, but same substance.
It sort of feels, though, that in a way, there were decades and decades of efforts to segregate in the 20th century that involved redlining, denying blacks mortgages and financial services, in all sorts of ways that had already segregated neighborhoods, right?
Right. That's exactly right. And it's also important to understand that the secession movement is only successful and segregating schools because students attend school for the most part where they live. Because we have high levels of residential segregation between cities or between municipalities, then when a municipality leaves a larger county-based district and forms its own district, by virtue of the fact that our city boundary lines are for the most part racially circumscribed, the school district boundary lines will be as well when they are able to secede.
Erica, David Pickler mentioned a more efficient school bureaucracy as one of the arguments in favor of secession. Is that backed up by your research?
It's actually, in many ways, more inefficient to create a smaller school system because you have to duplicate the same infrastructure in order to support the school system, but you're educating a smaller number of children. So it essentially costs more per dollar to do that. The other important part to consider is the resource drain that is taking away from the district from which the municipality is seceding, particularly with respect to teachers. When a school system secedes, it leaves the county-based or the place from which it's seceding on the hook for things like retirement costs that may move over to a new school district. So in many ways, it's inefficient in terms of the duplication of services and the increased costs.
So where is secession happening today and on what scale? How many states have laws on the books that allow secession?
The policy landscape for secession is somewhat of a mixed bag. So there are about 30 states that have explicit policies on the books. In the states that don't have explicit policies on the books regarding secession, the default understanding is that the state legislature has authority to decide if and on what term school districts can secede. So it's an ever-increasing number of municipalities who are attempting to secede or who have successfully seceded.
I was looking at a map of where secession has most taken place, and I was struck that a lot of these districts have been in Maine and in Alabama. And specifically, in the Birmingham, Alabama area alone, 8 towns have withdrawn or tried to withdraw from their districts since the 1950s. Is there something about Alabama that makes it easier for small towns to secede from larger districts?
Yes. Alabama is one of the states that makes secession relatively easy. In order to secede under Alabama law, you only need to show that you have a municipality of a certain size level and that you would essentially be able to sustain your own school district. And so particularly in the Birmingham area, the Jefferson County school system had not until recently put up much opposition to attempts by municipalities in that county to secede. And so especially with respect to Alabama, I don't think you can analyze this without looking at the racial history. That particular county, Jefferson County, where Birmingham is located, is still under a federal court desegregation order, has a pretty sordid history of resisting school desegregation. In fact, their first attempt to try and secede actually came very shortly after Brown, and they've only continued the trend.
Erica Wilson, law professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Indira Lakshmanan. For decades, ExxonMobil, the world's largest publicly traded oil and gas company, quote, misled the general public about climate change. That's the finding of two Harvard researchers who published a paper in the journal Environmental Research Letters earlier this week. The researchers reviewed the company's internal communications and scientific studies about greenhouse gas emissions and found Exxon knew about and acknowledged the human role in climate change in 80% of its internal documents. Yet 81% of the company's public messaging sowed doubt about climate change. In a statement sent to our partner station, WGBH, ExxonMobil called the Harvard paper, quote, inaccurate and preposterous, adding, our statements have been consistent with our understanding of climate science. Here to discuss the study is Jeffrey Suprin, a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University, who co-authored the peer-reviewed academic study comparing Exxon's climate change research with its public statements. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thanks for having me, Indira.
So how many and what kind of documents did you review, and what were the most striking findings?
So we studied 187 documents. Exxon has said that the allegations against it are false, and that anyone who looks into the evidence will see that. They've challenged the public to, quote, read the documents, to read all of these documents and make up your own mind. So we took up that challenge. Over the past year, we read all of the internal documents that have formed the basis of journalists' allegations and all of the peer-reviewed and non-peer-reviewed articles that Exxon has sent back in rebuttal to these allegations. We also looked at Exxon's so-called advertorials, paid advertisements in the New York Times. What we found is a gaping systematic discrepancy between, on the one hand, what the company said about climate change privately and in academic circles, and on the other, what it said to the public in the New York Times. Our work shows that Exxon has misled the public about climate science and its implications for decades by contributing quietly to climate science and loudly to raising doubts about it. One example on the peer-reviewed side is a 1996 study co-authored by an Exxon employee which said, "The body of statistical evidence now points towards the discernible human influence on global climate." Yet the year later, Exxon took out an editorial read by perhaps millions in the New York Times which said, "Let's face it, the science of climate change is too uncertain to mandate a plan of action that could plunge economies into turmoil. Scientists cannot predict with certainty if temperatures will increase, by how much, and where changes will occur. We still don't know what role man-made greenhouse gases might play in warming the planet."
Well, you know, you found that Exxon produced these advertorials that it placed in leading publications like the New York Times, costing on average $31,000 per advertorial. And you say that many of the things that they say in these public statements conflicted with research that the company itself published in the very same year. You suggest in your op-ed for the New York Times this week that ExxonMobil's communications may actually have broken the law. What makes you say that?
Well, we didn't say they've broken the law. We've said that our work is extremely relevant to ongoing investigations by the Attorneys General of Massachusetts and New York, by an ongoing federal probe by the Securities and Exchange Commission, and ongoing lawsuits from some of Exxon's own employees and shareholders. They're all asking the same question, and that's, have Exxon's communications about climate change misled its customers, shareholders, or the general public, including in ways that may have broken the law? And that's the question we address with our work. Have they misled the public? We're not lawyers, and it's important to clarify that our paper is an independent and peer-reviewed academic study, not a legal investigation.
Do you believe that you have some piece of evidence in your content analysis that is a smoking gun proving that Exxon knowingly misled the public about climate change?
Yes. In short, we found that roughly 80% of Exxon's peer-reviewed science and internal memos acknowledged that climate change is real and human cause. Yet essentially the same fraction of their advertorials, as you said, 81%, promoted doubt on the matter. The trends we observed are clear and systematic. Exxon has said that journalists and other critics have, quote, cherry-picked statements to come to our conclusions. However, we looked at the whole cherry tree, and the trends we've observed are clear and systematic.
Well, Exxon has been lauded for coming out in support of the Paris Climate Accords under President Obama. Has the company changed in the past couple of years, or is this indicative of publicly supporting one thing while actively subverting and distorting things behind the scenes?
Yeah, I think our work about the past is relevant to the present and the future. Our analysis shows that Exxon has a track record of sending mixed messages about climate change. And of course, as you allude to, the rhetoric has evolved, but we see the same patterns existing. Exxon and other fossil fuel companies, for example, say they acknowledge climate science, for example, wanting to ensure that we contribute and stay below 2 degrees according to the Paris Agreement. But they continue to double down on a business model incompatible with the science of stopping climate change. Likewise, Exxon says it supports a carbon tax, but it overwhelmingly gives money to congresspeople who don't.
The company is, as I said, the largest publicly traded oil and gas company in the world. Its former CEO, Rex Tillerson, is now Secretary of State. The Trump administration has showed itself to be very favorable to oil and gas interests. Do you feel that the company really has the upper hand in this case? They have accused you and your co-author of this study being paid for, written and published by activists leading a 5-year campaign against the company.
Yeah, this is very important to address. ExxonMobil says we are in it for the money. But let's be clear, Naomi Oreskes is my co-author. She is a Harvard professor, and she did this work on a standard Harvard salary with no additional payment from any source. She's never been on the payroll of any NGO or any other activist organization. And in fact, before becoming an academic, she worked in the Australian mining industry. Myself, I did 2 months of this work on a postdoctoral salary paid for by the Rockefeller Family Fund, which Exxon is apparently not a big fan of, but we disclosed that funding in our research. And then I did 11 more months of this research on my own dime, in parallel with other funded research projects. As you say, Exxon also accuses us of being activists, as though that is something to be ashamed of. But we're proud to be activists. You know, as scientists before us have shown, speaking truth to power is a civic duty, and today's climate demands that. But we are also credentialed academics, and that's important to clarify. Our findings are not just opinions, as ExxonMobil claims. They are evidence-based conclusions that we have passed the rigors of peer review by independent, anonymous experts in our field.
Jeffrey Suprin of Harvard University, co-author of the study findings on Exxon and climate change. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Indira.
Colin Kaepernick, the 49ers quarterback, has refused to stand through the first three preseason games during the national anthem.
And he's receiving heavy boos here.
Kaepernick saying, quote, "I'm not going to stand up to show pride in a flag for a country that oppresses black people and people of color."
NFL owners don't want to pick him up because they don't want to get a nasty tweet from Donald Trump. Do you believe that?
It's been a year since Colin Kaepernick got down on one knee during the national anthem in silent protest of the mistreatment of minorities in America. The former quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers continued to kneel the whole season, and today he's out of a job. Dave Zirin, sports editor of The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, explains why this story keeps getting bigger.
Colin Kaepernick is right now pretty much blackballed from the National Football League. He is not able to get a job, even though he is considered one of the better quarterbacks in the game. Can't even get a job as a backup. And there was a rally in New York City of 2,000 to 3,000 people in front of NFL offices very recently to protest this fact, which only shows what a phenomenon Colin Kaepernick has become, because his protest really has started this national discussion about police brutality, about police violence, and about the right to protest. Now, this has upset a lot of people. It's polarized a lot of people, but it's also influenced a lot of people. And I think we're seeing that right now as more players are taking a knee or sitting during the anthem early in this NFL preseason than I think anybody expected. It showed that Colin Kaepernick might be gone from the NFL for now, but his message is not.
Well, tell us about how the movement has spread to other players. How many people have been kneeling in the preseason games, and how much solidarity have we seen from white players?
Well, this is just beginning. I mean, it started last weekend with a player named Marshawn Lynch for the Raiders who sat during the anthem, and then Michael Bennett of the Seattle Seahawks. Now, after Michael Bennett sat, he made a plea for white players to take part in this as well. And talking to some of the players, as I have, who've been involved in these protests, since then other players have been involved. A dozen members of the Cleveland Browns took a knee. Several white players either putting their hands on the shoulders of their teammates, or in one case, Seth DeValve of the Browns taking a knee as well. But talking to these players, they are motivated by the idea that just by keeping Colin Kaepernick out of the game, that's not going to ensure their silence. But more than that, it really is Charlottesville. It really is the Trump presidency. It really is this idea that something has gone off the rails in this country with regards to race, and that they feel a need to say or do something about that with their platform as NFL players.
Well, has the NFL faced any backlash or pressure about essentially trying to limit free speech of one of its players? And given that they've blackballed Kaepernick and now so many other people are following his protest, they can't blackball the whole NFL.
No, they certainly can't. And that's, of course, one of the powers of protest itself. I mean, I think the backlash to the NFL on this front is really just beginning. At the rally that I attended, 2,000-3,000 people in front of NFL headquarters, there was a formal call for a boycott. The NAACP has called for a boycott, and it's worth noting that the NAACP has a long historical partnership with the NFL, so that is not a small thing. That's new. That's not something we've seen before. And again, it speaks to the impact that Colin Kaepernick has had, because listening to a lot of the rally speakers, one of the main themes is this idea of, okay, this isn't just about your typical NFL roster. This isn't just about one player. This is about whether or not speaking out could cost you your job. And this is about whether or not voices of resistance are going to be allowed under this presidency.
Dave Zirin, host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Tomorrow night, 40-year-old world boxing champion Floyd Mayweather Jr. steps out of retirement to face off with 26-year-old mixed martial arts superstar Conor McGregor in a highly anticipated boxing match in, where else? Sin City, Las Vegas. The fight was preceded by a four-city trash-talking tour where McGregor was criticized for using racially charged language and taunting his opponent, while Mayweather's domestic abuse past was largely ignored. The two fighters are expected to make tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars off the spectacle. Khalifa Sane is a staff writer for The New Yorker who's written about the fight. Welcome, Khalifa.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So when Floyd Mayweather announced he was retiring in 2015, you wrote an article questioning whether it was truly the end. Well, now he's back. Was this what you expected for a comeback?
No, it's not what I would have expected because it's ludicrous. Now, Floyd Mayweather is known for picking ludicrous fights. He's figured out that in boxing, no one's in charge. There's no structure. No one's in control. So if you're a popular fighter, you can literally handpick your opponent and then beat him. So Floyd Mayweather is always looking for the opponent that poses the lowest amount of risk and the highest amount of reward. And Conor McGregor, who's a famous star in mixed martial arts, which some non-fans think of as cage fighting or UFC. He's really famous, really popular, and not a professional boxer. So it's hard to imagine someone who would bring more reward and less risk to the table than Conor McGregor.
Wow. Well, tell us, for people who haven't been paying attention, about the lead up to this fight. There are all racial overtones and a lot of profane encounters, and it's sort of become almost like some kind of celebrity match, too.
And this is a boxing tradition, right? When we think of Muhammad Ali, part of what we think of is him taunting his opponent before, afterwards, sometimes during the fight. When we think of Mike Tyson, we think of him saying, you know, I want to eat his children. We think of this idea that two fighters build up some animosity so that viewers feel like they're not just watching an athletic event, they're watching a grudge match.
Mm-hmm.
The problem here is that because Floyd Mayweather and Conor McGregor compete in different sports, they don't have any history of animosity. They don't know each other. What they really are is businessmen who are embarking on a very lucrative joint venture. So they had to somehow do something to try and amp up some tension. Conor McGregor is a sort of virtuoso loudmouth. And at one point when Floyd Mayweather was moving around the stage, he said, "Dance for me, boy." And then Floyd Mayweather at some point came back and accused Conor McGregor of racism. And in the course of doing that, Floyd Mayweather used an anti-gay slur and sort of had to apologize for that. So yes, it's a carnival, it's chaos. And you know, unlike some other forms of entertainment, you know, if you're on a primetime TV show, if you make the advertisers too angry or uncomfortable, they're going to pull the ads, maybe your show gets canceled. With something like this, this is going to be broadcast on pay-per-view. It's going to cost about $100. So what they want is they want everyone who might possibly buy the fight to buy the fight. And if the rest of the population, people that would never spend $100 to watch two guys hitting each other in the head, if all those people are sort of turned off, horrified, ashamed for their country, deeply offended, that doesn't matter to these two. And I think part of the genius of this promotion was that here are two guys who aren't afraid to be offensive. And here are two guys who are saying whatever they want, and there's not really any consequences because there's no one to punish them.
I have to ask you the meta question, which is, does this diminish the sport of boxing? There are so many boxing purists out there who will go back and look at, you know, the heyday of the sport. Does this take away from that history or from the legitimate boxers out there today who are being overshadowed by this spectacle?
I mean, boxing has long been this mixture of the high-minded and the sordid. And you know, back in the glory days of Muhammad Ali, a lot of people thought that that was somehow ruining, debasing, cheapening the sport. Certainly, a lot of the big Mike Tyson fights, especially the one everyone remembers where he took a bite, two bites, actually, out of Evander Holyfield's ear, that was a fiasco. And yet, that's a moment that we all remember. So the one thing about boxing is that if it were possible to kill boxing, it would be dead by now because people, especially boxers themselves, have been trying for a long time and failing.
Khalifa Sane is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'll see you at the fight.
I'll be there in spirit. For the fourth time this year in Texas, a federal court has ruled that the state legislature passed intentionally discriminatory voting laws. Earlier this week, U.S. District Judge Nelva Gonzalez-Ramos blocked Texas from enforcing a revamped voter ID law that the judge said put an undue burden on Black and Hispanic voters. Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott has long said that strict voter ID laws are needed to avoid fraud. The state's attorney general, Ken Paxton, called the judge's decision outrageous and said he'll appeal. Stephen Vladek is a professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin, and he joins me now to explain the legal battle. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is the significance of this decision after this law had already been revised to try to address concerns of an earlier court decision?
There are a couple of different reasons why this week's decision is so important. You know, the first is, as you say, the Texas legislature had gone back to the drawing board after Judge Gonzalez-Ramos's earlier decision to try to fix the law, to try to basically eliminate or at least ameliorate some of the problems she identified. And what Judge Gonzalez-Ramos ruled this week is that they actually made it worse, that the revisions to the law were actually more problematic from the perspective of the Voting Rights Act and the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. This is also, however, I think, a really interesting and bad loss for the Trump Justice Department, which had quite notably changed positions. This was originally a case brought by the federal government against the state of Texas. When the Trump DOJ switched sides at the beginning of this year, I think a lot of folks saw that as a bellwether for an important shift in the role of the federal government. Well, Judge Gonzalez-Ramos found the federal government's arguments no more convincing than the state's. So this is a loss for the Justice Department under Jeff Sessions as much as it's a loss for the state of Texas.
All right. So what's likely to happen next? As you've said, the Trump administration's Justice Department has been supportive of a nationwide push for stronger voter ID laws. Are they going to step in and help Texas in its appeal against this federal ruling?
Oh, I think there's no doubt that they will. And so, as you know, Attorney General Paxton said shortly after Judge Gonzalez-Ramos handed down her ruling, this is now going to go to the Fifth Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court in New Orleans, which also obviously covers Texas. The Fifth Circuit is usually pretty conservative and usually, you know, errs on the side of the states. But on the redistricting cases, you know, the other part of this coin that we've seen this year, the Fifth Circuit's already ruled against Texas twice and held that gerrymandering of certain districts was actually unconstitutional on racial discrimination grounds. So I think it's not obvious that Texas and DOJ wins if and when this case is heard by an appeals court.
At this point, Texas could actually be forced into federal oversight of its voting procedures because of the number of federal court rulings against its voter laws. Isn't that right?
Yeah. So under the Voting Rights Act, there is this whole regime of preclearance. And it's theoretically possible that a court could find that Texas has been so obviously rampant and blatant in its efforts to discriminate that it's, you know, ready to be put back under that especially punitive regime. The problem is that the Supreme Court in its 2013 decision in the Shelby County case actually made it a lot harder to enforce that aspect of the Voting Rights Act. And so it might very well fall back to the Trump Justice Department, which, as we've seen in this case, is in no hurry to aggressively enforce those provisions.
Was there evidence, Stephen, of some problem with voter fraud in Texas that this law was trying to address?
So one of the things that Judge Gonzalez-Ramos found in her earlier 2014 ruling was that the evidence the legislature had purportedly relied on when it enacted the initial version of this law, what was called SB 14, really wasn't convincing or persuasive and didn't overcome the evidence to the contrary that at least part of what the legislature was trying to do was disenfranchised members of particular minority groups. This time around, when Judge Gonzalez-Ramos was confronted with the new bill, she basically found that, you know, if anything, the changes were not just cosmetic, but were perhaps intended to benefit majority voters, white voters, and to make it no easier and perhaps in some ways harder for minority voters to use different kinds of identification to access the polls.
The Texas decision this week, of course, is just the latest in a string of legal decisions over the last year related to voting rights in states across the country. So put Texas's in a national context for us. What has the trend been as you read it?
Well, I think what the trend has been for legislatures, especially but not always Republican-controlled legislatures, to really push the envelope of what courts have previously allowed, to try to gerrymander districts to maximize the number of seats that the majority party can control and minimize the impact not just of the minority party but of minority groups, to try to make it harder for different parts of the population to vote, and basically to try to maximize and consolidate electoral power in state houses, in federal congressional races, even in presidential races. And I think this is the real question that Congress and the president's electoral commission ought to be considering, which is, you know, why are we so committed to making it so hard to vote and to making it so likely that you're going to have districts that just aren't really representative of how divided the country currently is? Is that healthy? And I think what the courts are trying to say, at least when they're able to, is the answer is no.
You know, you mentioned gerrymandering. There was a new study out this week that suggested that the Democrats would get a majority in congressional races next year, but would still lose due to gerrymandering. Texas itself recently had a controversial ruling on redistricting, and I wonder whether that is likely to put it under some sort of federal oversight.
So I think, again, I mean, the way the Voting Rights Act, when it was passed in 1965, was designed to work, absolutely, this kind of pattern of misbehavior by a state like Texas ought to have brought it within the umbrella of federal oversight. But between the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby County and the Justice Department's own real reversal of enforcement priorities, you know, the Voting Rights Act just doesn't have the teeth anymore that it was meant to have. And that's part of why I think so many folks are paying attention to the upcoming Supreme Court case over partisan gerrymandering in Wisconsin. If the justices are about to breathe new life into the idea that the Constitution imposes constraints on how states draw local lines, state lines, federal lines, you know, I think this is going to have ramifications perhaps as early as the 2020 elections, if not sooner.
Stephen Vladeck is a professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. I'm Indira Lakshmanan in this week. Todd Zwillick returns on Monday. We've been talking a lot this week about monuments to American historical figures and how they play into our current politics. But did you know, beginning in 1864, every state was asked to donate two statues of prominent residents to the U.S. Capitol building as part of the National Statuary Hall collection? States have updated them over the years, and there are 100 statues in the collection, including folks you'd expect, like Sam Adams and Dwight Eisenhower, inventors including Thomas Edison, and Confederates like Jefferson Davis. In some ways, it's a diverse group. In others, not so much. We'll get to that in a second. We asked you for ideas on who you'd like to see represented from your state.
My name is Sharon. I'm calling from Canton, Ohio. And for our statues, I would nominate Toni Morrison. Of all the famous Ohioans, she brings prose and poetry that's a magnificent gift.
This is Amber from Worcester, Massachusetts, and I think that Massachusetts should honor the one and only Helen Keller because she changed the world for people with and without disabilities, demonstrating that nothing can hold you back. Even though she was born in Alabama, I think that Massachusetts deserves to put up her statue because she came of age here and continues to inspire people of the Commonwealth each and every day.
It turns out that Helen Keller is already in there, but if Toni Morrison were to be honored, she'd be the only African-American in Statuary Hall. That's because of all the statues donated by the 50 states, there are zero African-Americans. None. There are only four statues of African-Americans in the entire Capitol building, in fact. A bust of Martin Luther King Jr. was added in 1986, and statues of Rosa Parks, Frederick Douglass, and Sojourner Truth were added during the Obama presidency. Vivian Green Freed is a professor at Vanderbilt University and the author of Art and Empire, The Politics of Ethnicity in the United States Capitol, 1815 to 1865.
So there are 100 statues. 12 of them depict Confederate leaders, including Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. Virginia, for example, had proposed Robert E. Lee in 1903. They deliberately waited enough time after the Civil War to make this proposal, knowing that if it were closer to the Civil War, there would be objections. Like the Confederate monuments located throughout the South. They were all, as well as those in the U.S. Capitol building, they're all intended to put the African Americans in their place at a moment where the Jim Crow laws are being instated and you have the Harlem Renaissance, for example, in the 1920s and the Great Migration. The Great Migration of African Americans from the South to the North occurs at this very period we're talking about.
So tell me, Vivian, among the 50 states, did any of them actually choose an African American as one of their two figures from their state's history to represent in the Capitol?
No, they did not. And that takes on significance given the history of the sculpture and paintings located in and on the U.S. Capitol building. I'll talk about the statue on top of the dome of the U.S. Capitol building that everybody knows, but few people really know what it represents. So the statue is called Statue of Freedom. And when the statue was proposed in 1850 by the architect of the U.S. Capitol extension, he had suggested that the statue represent liberty. When the person in charge of the Capitol extension saw this design, and his name is Jefferson Davis, who at the time was the Secretary of War, and he was in charge of the decoration of the U.S. Capitol building, he rejected this image, and he said, its history, that is, the history of the personification of liberty, renders it inappropriate to a people who were born free and would not be enslaved. And that is really a problematic statement to be said by somebody who owned slaves on a plantation and, of course, would be the future president of the Confederacy. He didn't allow any works of art in the U.S. Capitol building to show slaves. And that has taken until the beginning of the 21st century. I consider that to be a hallmark, an indication of race relations in this country that are really problematic.
So, Vivian, tell me a little bit about the history of Native Americans fighting to remove some of the offensive iconography in their view from the U.S. Capitol.
So there are two statues that were located on the east facade of the U.S. Capitol building on the staircase. They were huge. It showed a gigantic white pioneer who is restraining a male Mohawk who is holding a scalp and is getting ready to scalp and kill a white woman and her child who represent civilization, Christianity, and democracy. So what happens is already in 1938, some of the Native peoples were writing letters to protest against these images. It's not anything that was ever discussed in Congress. You're never going to find any kind of resolution that was passed. So in 1953, all the statues on the east facade of the U.S. Capitol building were taken down because they were made of sandstone and they were not surviving the weather conditions, and they were replaced by copies. But those two statues were never replaced. They are in storage outdoors someplace in Virginia, and they have fallen apart.
So this is an example of history actually being erased. And this brings me back to the question of you. I understand your personal history is that you're the daughter of a Holocaust survivor. So tell me, have you studied how has Germany dealt with its own history, and how should we in the United States be dealing with the ugliest parts of our history?
Well, I lived in Berlin for a year not too long ago. And what I was struck by is that in Germany and in Berlin in particular, you have so many memorials and monuments that record the Holocaust, so that there are these cobblestones in front of apartment buildings throughout Germany. You have so many remembrances. So I'm able to literally find up the name of one of my ancestors, and I know exactly when she was taken to which concentration camp, when she was moved to another concentration camp, when she was killed in Theresienstadt. That is a history that needs to be remembered so that it never happens again. And I'd say that that's what we need to be doing in this country. We have some things in our past that are not perfect. We are an amazing country. My mother was rescued by the Quakers. If it weren't for the Quakers and my uncle, Henry Reese, who did everything in his power to get my mother out, and I'm sorry, I'm getting very emotional now, I would not be alive. This is a history that needs to be acknowledged and remembered. My mother was able to come to this country. I'm able to be a professor at Vanderbilt University because my mother was able to come to this country. And so the parts of our history that are not ideal, slavery, the ways in which Native peoples have been treated, rather than erasing it, I think we have to talk about it. I think we have to remember it. I think it needs to be a point of discussion.
Vivian Green-Fried, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Indira, it was my pleasure.
Vivian Green-Fried is a professor at Vanderbilt University and author of Art and Empire, The Politics of Ethnicity in the United States Capitol. We've been hearing from lots of you about who you think should have a statue in the U.S. Capitol building. A listener from Kissimmee, Florida. I wish Puerto Rico could participate, too. I would nominate Julia de Burgos for her poetry and feminism. She was ahead of her time and continues to inspire around the world today.
Trish from Huntington, West Virginia. Katherine Johnson to represent and inspire women and men to push ahead and set precedents where it's needed.
Give us your take at 877-8MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Indira Lakshmanan of the Poynter Institute. You can follow me at Indira_L. Todd Zwillick is back on Monday. This is The Takeaway.